Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
First this morning, it's competition time. We've got a double prize this morning up for grabs. Mariah Carey is coming to the Three Arena on the 22nd of May, and I've got a pair of tickets to see her then. But I also have a pair of tickets to see the comedy show Three Hail Marys at the Olympia, which runs from May the 30th to the 1st of June. So to be in with a chance of winning the tickets for both shows, answer this very, very difficult question. Mariah Carey wanted one thing for Christmas. Was it you or a chocolate orange? You can text your answer A or B and your name and address to 51551, and I'll announce the winner before the end of today's show. Now to some music. Well, The Academic, they're one of the biggest bands around at the moment. They released their debut album, Tales from the Backseat, last year, which reached number one in the charts and was nominated for Album of the Year at the Choice Music Prize, and of course was Album of the Week on BBC Radio 1. Well, they've got lots of gigs lined up for this summer, including the Marquee in Cork and the Ivy Gardens in Dublin, and I'm delighted that two of the band members are here this morning to play live in our studio. Craig Fitzgerald and Matt Murta, you're both very welcome to the show. We'll chat in a moment. First of all, you're going to sing for us one of your songs, Why Can't We Be Friends? One, two,
three, four. And don't leave me here, especially not with her. People get lost, and we don't even talk. So don't drink my fear, but when I've had too much. You've heard of people get lost. I want to see you in the dark. And it falls and it breaks and it turns into something new. And I say, something new. And it turns into something new.
Great song. You've beautiful voice. Your voice is amazing as well.
Cheers, thanks a million.
How did you originally get together and form your band?
We met in school. We went to a school called St. Joseph's, Rochford Bridge. And Matt used to play guitar at lunchtime. And we'd go into a classroom. And I used to be into rap music, not guitar music at all. And then he showed me Oasis and I was like, that's not cool. And then I quickly changed my mind and started learning kind of off him.
Yeah, we just kind of grew up together, bonded over a lot of music. Typical, I guess, story of a band getting together. And then we sort of, I guess when school was just finishing around 6 year and our Leaving Cert, we kind of decided, you know, let's make a stab at this. Like, let's give it a proper go. And I went to college for a little bit, but then kind of decided to go all in. And it's been that way ever since.
Yeah, but look, it really worked for you. And didn't you open last year for the Rolling Stones in Croke Park?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah, strange.
What was it like?
I mean, it just went so quick on the day itself. The build-up was quite long. And we knew about it like for a little while before it was announced. So we had to kind of like remain tight-lipped and like...
Didn't even tell our parents.
We were like told not to even tell our parents because they would let it slip.
Of course,
you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it was crazy. But then on the day, yeah, we played a gig which felt like we were...
Yeah, it was indescribable. Yeah, and we didn't think we were going to get to meet them either. And their production manager led us down into a secret area of Croke Park, I think. And we got to meet them and it was just like, you know, meeting an alien race almost. It was like, these are the godfathers of...
Yeah. Were they friendly? Guitar.
Yeah, they were just absolutely lovely. Like, I remember Keith Richards, my brother Stephen is in the band, and he looked at us and he was like, oh, you two are brothers, aren't you? I can tell. And I was just like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. Keith Richards is talking to me.
And Mick Jagger had more energy than I've ever had before at any gig.
Yeah.
You know, a good bit younger.
Yeah, a fair bit younger. And look, this summer, I know you're going to be the Marquee in Cork, aren't you, on the 27th of June. Mm-hmm. And I think in the Ivy Gardens in Dublin on the 19th of July. And of course, tickets are in sale for both now. Tickets from Ticketmaster.ie. But also nice, you're going to Donegal's Oak Fest in June and the Galway International Arts Festival.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're going to be special shows. Cork in particular, I mean, we've... I don't know what it is about that city, but we've always seemed to resonate down there. And we've all, I mean, last year we played the Opera House and we've kind of just built it slowly up there. And it was a big decision for us to decide to play the Marquee because it's obviously such a large venue. But we were feeling the love from Cork, so we decided why not. And Ivy Gardens as well, we played a summer show there last year and it's just an incredible venue. So really looking forward to getting back there.
Yeah, well, I think people are going to be really looking forward to going and buying those tickets to both the Marquee and the Ivy Gardens. You're going to sing one more song for us this morning, Bear Claws?
Yes, yeah,
that's right.
Okay, well, listen to both of you, Craig and Matt. Thanks so much for coming in on a Sunday morning. I'm always amazed at how people sing so well at this ungodly hour. But thanks so much and the very
thanks
best of luck.
Yeah,
thank you.
Off you go.
All right.
I know it's a little old-fashioned, holding hands, now start your romancing. Show me all your flaws, show me your bear claws, go rip your heart out tonight. You don't have to be cool to make me shiver. Look in my eyes, can I make this any clearer? Just a late night girl calling through a phone. She never really loved you, so just leave her alone. Your mama says it's over when you come through the door, saying that's enough for you. Now won't you shut your mouth? Hey. Strange. Now the boy in the backseat, staying in the backseat, trying to make sense of it all. He's saying we were such a good thing, we were such a good thing. How could you let this fall? Take all my money and meet me on the sidewalk. If you don't show, then I know you were just a lady. So just leave it alone. Your mama said. me your bare claws. Go rip your heart out tonight. You were just a late night girl calling through the phone. She never really loved you, so just leave her alone. Your mama says it's over when you come through the door, saying that's enough for you now, won't you? Shut your mouth. That's enough for you, kid. Now you go inside, love. Hey, oh, I'll never let you go. Hey, oh, I'll never let you go. Hey, oh, I'll never let you go. Hey, oh, I'll never let you go.
Oh, love it, guys. Lots of love for you from our listeners. What a better way to start your Sunday than with some great tunes from The Academic. Don't miss them when they play Heineken Big Top on the 20th of July. Right. Listening to The Academic, says another, is definitely a great start to our morning. Jimmy in Donegal says, class lads, looking forward to seeing you at Oakfield Park in Donegal. And another says, I love the acoustic songs with Miriam this morning. The Academic, absolutely brilliant. And as I said, you're going to be at both the Marquee in Cork on the 27th of June and the Ivy Gardens in Dublin on the 19th of July. Tickets on sale for both now. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, the Celtic Festival of Bealtaine was an important moment in the lives of all of our foremothers and forefathers, a time to light bonfires and celebrate the glories of summer. But now it's also the name of the festival, which celebrates creativity in older age. And throughout this month, there are events nationwide which promote creativity, physical activity and personal development. And joining me now from our Galway studio is someone who calls herself an older artist, but she's in fact a brilliant filmmaker, also an activist, Lelia Doolan, who was once famously described by Archbishop John Charles McQuaid as mad, bad and dangerous. Good morning, Lelia Doolan.
I think that's a bit of a story now, honest to God, Miriam. When did I ever call myself older? I never did. But however, I accept your nomenclature, as they say. Listen, it's a lovely morning over here in Galway, so I hope it's very kind to you there lot as well.
It is, Lee. It's actually beautiful here in Dublin as well. Listen, tell me, because you've got so many hats and so many strings to your bow, but tell me about the Bealtaine Festival. It is.
That's what I'm here to really do. I didn't realise that I was old until they said to me, will you come and say a few words? People who are old, I don't think they know they're old. But I'll tell you a bit that has been going on, it is going on.
Yeah.
You've just missed, if you didn't get up early this morning, you missed the Bealtaine Dawn Chorus in Dock Road, the Dunmore East Library, County Waterford. They were up at 8 o'clock this morning. The other things that I think are, you know, there are millions of activities all over the country, from poetry to dancing to bardic carry-on. There's a bicycle gang in Dublin on the 17th of May. There are things in Wexford and Waterford at Hook Head. It's a multicultural project. It's on the 18th and the 25th of May. I'm being very good here. I'm reading out all these grand things.
Great.
And in, and there's a wonderful men's shed. I think the men's shed movement is just a great idea. And women have had it always, so it's very good to see men getting a chance. There's a men's shed in Kilcock, and they are having an event at the end of this month. There are suitcase arias in St. Nicholas's in Galway on the 24th of May. And you missed events on death yesterday, which mightn't have been any harm, in Dublin. There was a big discussion on death and what comes after death. I've no idea about that.
Were you at that?
Unfortunately, no, I missed it. But there you go. I just was listening to Seamus Ennis this morning on John Bowman saying, I'm not going to die, you know, I'm not going to die. And I think there are quite a few people who feel the same way.
Yeah, actually, that was a lovely programme. Had a stellar career in broadcasting here in RT, and then you went, is that right, Lydia? You chose to go and live in Galway. And there, if I'm right, but correct me if I'm wrong, I think you were very involved in establishing the Irish Film Board, the Galway Film FLA. Is that right? And why did you choose to go west?
I thought I was going to become a doctor. I was interested in medicine. I still am. And I thought that I might study and become a doctor. But in actual fact, I did other things instead. Joe Comerford sort of lassoed me and turned me aside and asked me to produce a film which we then did, his film, Reefer and the Model, which was, you know, of its time, I suppose, a bit iconoclastic. But that's, I think, what people ought to be. And being mad, bad and dangerous is a very good thing if you actually happen to be that. I would call myself very calm, mild and, you know, gentle kind of a character. But, yeah, being creative, is part of what every human being is. You know, look at your own career, look at what you're at. Everybody is full of ideas, creativity, imagination, vision. And I think old people, generally speaking, are the kind of, I think I said this at the opening, they're a sort of repository, a sort of a soak pit for future generations. And, you know, because they've been through most of the catastrophes that life brings throws to people. And if they have the quality of soaking it up and transforming it into some kind of generosity, which I think, you know, the Irish people are a wonderful people, whatever about the way we are led, I kind of think that can do nothing but be good. Albert Camus apparently said one time that so much happens to you in a single day that you could live the rest of your life in solitary confinement. And I was thinking about that driving in here this morning and the absolutely incredible things that happen to you within the course of 5 minutes. You know, mm-hmm. I also feel, you know, that we are living in a society which is not as kindly as it ought to be. I think we've more or less abandoned the church and all its rigors for a sort of bureaucracy, which is in the end debilitating and demeaning in many ways, and stops that spontaneity, which is really part of all human, the impulse of humanity. Now, this isn't to moan and groan. I think what you do is you get up and get on with the next best thing. And nobody does everything alone. You know, you don't do things alone. I haven't achieved things because of me, but because of the other people who have been serious and giants in the enterprises that I find myself involved in. And that, to me, is all of age. You know, we never stop aging, for God's sake, until we finish it. And in the meantime, laughter and mirth and enjoyment and villainy and badness, as Bernadette Devlin calls, which is to be creatively at ways of trying to change the society you're in. I kind of feel that old people may not perhaps be as visible as they ought to be within the sort of ideas of the state. I feel that, you know, for now and again, people in the country need a bit of verbal encouragement from the people who lead us. And I think that there is far too much instant acrimony and what would you call it? Cruelty, really. Personal cruelty between people. Are you still there?
Yes, I am. I like listening to you.
I stopped
talking. Not to interrupt
you. I stopped talking. But it's a bloody great world. That's the fact of the matter.
You mentioned Bernadette there, of course, the great Bernadette Devlin, and you made that wonderful film about her called, I think, Bernadette Notes in a Political Journey, or Bernadette Notes. How intertwined are politics and culture and art for you? You've always married both, in a sense, haven't you, Lydia?
That's really what I think, I suppose, most life is about. You know, the passionate heart really gets on with the thing day after day. And there are so many people in the world who have to go through pain and suffering. That finding somebody to stand with you, to hold out your hand. I remember this morning listening to Liam Flynn saying, you know, when Seamus Ennis, with his great, pale, beautiful face, came out of hospital, they gathered around and they found him a corner and a little bit of a room to put him in. Now, this is what people do for one another. This is what the world is about. It's looking out for your neighbour. And I suppose, I shouldn't be talking about these things, but about the Bealtaine Festival, which is what I'm supposed to be promoting. I suppose, you know, as I said earlier, with mirth and laughter, let old wrinkles come. That was the old Shakespearean adage. And I kind of feel this is what Bealtaine does. It just reminds one, reminds us, that life is an absolute marvel. It's a cornucopia of possibilities.
But look, you've had a wonderful journey because I read, now this could be wrong, Lydia, but let me know, that as a child you learned the long poem, The Lady of Shalott, off by heart.
Gosh.
And performed it for your teacher who was astonished. Is that correct?
Where did you get that from? My
Is it
God.
True, more importantly?
I love it. I love it. I'm going to say a bit of it now, shall I?
Oh, yeah, go. Can you still remember it?
I can. There's a bit, you know, a wonderful bit, which was, I suppose, what really engaged my mind. Willows whiten, aspens quiver, little breezes dusk and shiver through the wave that runs forever by the island in the river flowing down to Camelot. And then it goes on.
Well, your creativity obviously was there when you were a tiny child and you've kept it going and it's still going as strong for you.
Well, no, there was a family. I had a mother and father who loved one another, and I had brothers and sisters of the same ilk. And there's nothing like people to encourage one. You know, it wasn't that I was particularly any more creative than anybody else, but I was encouraged. And I think that's what people do to one another and can do, instead of pulling one another down, which seems to be part of this age of instant audacity.
Well, our listeners aren't like that. Anne Wren says, go on, Lelia, one mighty woman. Us oldies are invisible at times. We'll keep trying. We'll make our voices heard. Regards. Rory O'Sullivan says, hi, Miriam. We should all be grateful for Lelia's superb documentary on the equally superb Bernadette Devlin. And another says, settle an argument, please, Lelia. Did you write a book titled Stand Up and Be Counted? Many thanks. That's from Maria.
I participated with Jack Dowling in a book called Sit Down and Be Counted, and it was about the evolution of RTE, and it was about, it was a bit of a genius title in the end, we felt, you know, because here we are, and the whole thing about the TAM research, how many people were watching the television at what time, yeah. But really the question that we wanted to raise was, what was it that they were watching? Had it anything to do with the lives they led? And was it particularly interesting and provocative and, you know, drew out their own ideas about things? There's no interactive television anymore, really, except by way of games and that kind of thing. And, long ago there used to be a talk back system where actually people came along and told you how appalling you were or how, you know, all of those are things that we... Constructive criticism is wonderful.
Yeah. Well, go on, Lydia.
No, that's enough. That's perfectly enough.
But look, as you say, the sun is shining in Galway.
Yes.
I've loved talking to you. So give me one more line on Bealtaine, since that was our main thing we're promoting here this morning.
I'm going to go and have a swim now. And I'm hoping that a lot of people will think the same, get the same idea and be careful. Bealtaine is about... celebration is an overused word, but it's about saying, damn it to hell, lads, we're here. Let's make the most of it. Let's give it a good old rattle.
There you go. Finally, are you swimming in the sea or in a pool?
Oh, in the sea, of course.
Yeah. Well done, you. Where do you swim?
Down near where I live with a bunch of wild women swimmers, my neighbours.
Is it freezing when you get in?
It was not that hot yesterday, but it's going to be really warm today.
Good.
So take heart.
Well, our listeners send their love.
And I send mine to you all, and thanks a million.
Thank you, Lydia.
Get out and do something wild.
I'll tell them that is your mantra. Great. Lydia Dillon, thanks so much for joining us this morning. And best of luck in your swim and everything else. Just before we take a break, you may remember that last week I spoke to the indomitable Ruth Morrissey. She was given, as you know, a landmark payout recently due to an incorrect cervical check reading. Well, she is terminally ill and she also previously had a double mastectomy. But when I was chatting to her, she mentioned she tried to get tickets for the sold-out Ariana Grande show in September for her 7-year-old daughter, Libby. Well, thanks to the wonderful people at MCD, I'm delighted to say that we have 3 tickets here now. And not only that, but the 1878 Club at the 3 Arena have offered to look after Ruth, her husband Paul and Libby, their daughter, with dinner before the concert. And we even have a night in the very lovely Trinity Hotel so they can all make a proper and perfect trip of it. Thanks here to Ciara McKeown and RT for organising it. But most of all, my very best wishes to Ruth, Paul and Libby. And we all hope they have a brilliant time at the Ariana Grande concert and have a brilliant time in Dublin. We'll take a break. Well, it's hard to believe that the band Madness, also known as the Camden Nutty Boys, was formed 40 years ago this year, and to celebrate the anniversary they're back on tour, including soon at the Beachyard Festival in Dunleary this June. And I'm delighted to say that their lead singer Suggs joins me on the line now. Good morning, Suggs.
Good morning, Miriam. How are you?
Great. And yourself?
Not too bad at all.
you're coming back to Ireland shortly, and I know you honestly really like coming back here because you enjoy performing here, don't you?
We've had some great times in Ireland, you know, innumerable. You know, we played there in Dublin's First City on New Year's Eve, and so many great festivals. And, you know, Ireland is a place of joy, poetry and music, and that madness all over.
In my car, it's not quite a Jaguar. I bought it in Primrose Hill from a boat from Brazil. It was made in 59 in a factory by the Tyne.
Tell me about your background a little. You were born Graham McPherson, wasn't? And I think your mum was a jazz singer.
That's right, yeah. So we're talking about the Celtic roots. So my father was Scottish. I was born in London. My mum was Welsh. My wife's Irish. So we are Celts through and through.
Your mum, she used to bring you, did she, to jazz clubs in Soho when you were very small?
Yeah, I had a very colourful upbringing. Yeah, my poor old dad was a heroin addict. He got caught up in the wrong end of things. And my mum was a singer, and I used to have to go about with her to the nightclub. But, you know, what a great upbringing. You know, I was around music, I was around bohemian people and very tolerant people. And I learned a lot from that period of my life. I was very fortunate then to fall in with the band, who were equally bohemian when I was a kid, because I came from a rather rough part of North London. But we all had this sort of aspiration to do more than just, you know, work on the motorway.
Naughty boys in nasty schools, headmasters breaking all the rules, having fun and playing pool, smashing up the woodwork tools. All the teachers in the pub, passing round the ready rub, trying not to think of when the lunchtime bell will ring again. Oh, what fun we had, but did it really turn out bad? All I learned in school was how to bend, not break the rule. Oh, what fun we had, but at that time it seems so bad, trying different ways to make a difference through the head.
When did you yourself realise you could make music? When did you start making music?
Well, I was asked to join the band one night outside a cinema in Hampstead in North London. I was always a very charismatic kid, but I'd never thought about singing. But I don't even know if it's the DNA for my mum, but I just started singing with the band. And I tell you, the turning point was they threw me out of the band because I used to be a football hooligan. And I used to go to Chelsea instead of turning up to rehearsals on a Saturday. And then one time our keyboard player saw me on Match of the Day, a football match when I should have been at a rehearsal, and threw me out of the band. And I went to see them perform at our local school, William Ellis, when I was about 16, 17. And suddenly realised, you know, I'd lost my chance to be on stage. You know, I was in the audience and I thought, no, I should be up there, not down here. And that's when I started to take it seriously, and the rest of the band started to take it seriously. And it was that Mike Barton, our keyboard player, who turned it round for me, because he said, look, if we concentrate, we could actually make a living out of it.
How long after was it when, you know, your big hits like Our House peaked? I mean, did you have a long lead-in before you hit that kind of success, Suggs?
Yeah, a little bit. And, you know, this is the other connection with Ireland, is we were in Camden Town, which is a very Irish part of North London, and all the pubs there. We got a residency at a place called the Dublin Castle, which was run by some old pals, some of my mates, anyway. And they gave us a residency. And it was during that period, really, that we started to see queues forming around the block, and then record companies started to turn up. I suddenly believed what Mike and the rest of them were saying, that we could actually make a living out of it.
Staying in her sleep. Brother's got a date to keep, he can't hang around.
Our house in the middle of our street. Our house.
You you know, we made a record in 1979 when I was 18 with Two Tone Records, which was the Specials and all that. Mm. And it went to number 16 in the charts. And suddenly it was off, you know, we were off. And then from then on, we had hit after hit.
Do you have a special affection for one of your hits, or did you like them? Obviously, Our House, everyone knows, Driving in My Car, Must Be Love, House of Fun, Baggy Trousers. But which of those did you like most?
I suppose I'd have to say It Must Be Love. It's a very simple sentiment. But apparently, it's now become the most popular song at the weddings and indeed funerals. It's overtaken I Will Always Love You by Whitney Houston.
Wow.
And it's such a simple song, but I still see people crying when they hear us playing that today.
I never thought I'd miss you half as much as I do. And I never thought I'd feel this way, the way I feel about you. As soon as I wake up every night, every day, I know that it's you I need to take the blues away. It must be love, love, love. It must be love, love, love. Nothing more, nothing less. Love is the best.
In Dunleary, we can expect to hear all those hits?
You certainly can. And more. And more besides. Great, we've got some great support bands, and it's going to be a great night.
And you've a fascinating story, because you did a one-man show a couple of years back about your family sugs, and one of the things you talk about in is discovering a sister of yours in Ireland, because your mum had put her up for adoption. How did she discover your mum?
It's a long story, but yeah, I'd had this strange sort of, I'd done two one-man shows. One was about the fact that I never knew what happened to my dad. He disappeared when I was a kid, and I found out, unfortunately, it didn't work out too good for him. And there was always this kind of sadness in my mum, which I discovered was because she'd had to have my sister adopted, and ended up in Dublin, Julie. And she found out, because she's seen a repeat of This Is Your Life, which is a TV programme that I am to appear on, and she saw my mum and recognised her maiden name, which is Gower, my mum from Wales, and suddenly made connection, because my mum was trying to find her, but you know, you can't find adopted children. That isn't the way it goes. They have to find you. Anyway, my mum just got a message on Facebook saying, I think you might be my mum. And I very fortunately discovered that, where my sister was. And my mum died a couple of years ago. I had the great privilege of standing, you know, with my sister, with my mum, when she was in hospital, and to know that my mum knew that her adopted daughter was all right. You know, it was a privilege, yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, look, Suggs Madness, as I said, you're coming to the Beach Art Festival in Dunleary this coming June. And all the big hits of yours you'll be playing. Absolutely. Thanks so much for chatting to us today, Suggs.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Take care.
Well, last Sunday saw the final episode in the most recent series of the BBC drama Line of Duty. The drama has been getting massive audiences, and the standout star is Superintendent Ted Hastings, also known as Adrian Dunbar. Adrian, of course, has starred in many other films, including Hear My Song, My Left Foot, and The Crying Game, and I'm delighted to say that Adrian joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Adrian Dunbar.
Hi, Miriam. How are you?
Thanks so much. Listen, you gave me a heart attack last Sunday as I watched. I thought, no, you cannot be the baddie.
I know, yeah. But everybody seemed gripped by the whole thing, yeah. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody really wanted Ted to be the baddie. You know, he's been the kind of moral core of the whole thing all the way through. So, but Jed is very good at teasing all that out.
It's a wonderful character, though, isn't it, Adrian? And obviously, you mentioned Jed there, which is Jed Mercurio, of course, that yeah. great writer. But he's brilliantly charactered, isn't he, your character?
Yeah, he is. He's got lots of really good things going for him and lots of really bad things as well. So, yeah, no, he's good. He's kind of a very good manager. He's the kind of person I think that we all think should be sort of running something like AC12, a unit that's overseeing the police. You know, we like to think that there is someone in charge there who will stick to the letter of the law, who can't be bought. And also he's a bit old school. You know, his values are a bit old school. He's not very good with women, it has to be said. He's all right with them when they're in uniform, but maybe not so much when they're out. And I think women do like him because they know they could kind of basically wrap him round their finger in 20 minutes. So he's one of those type of characters that people respond to. And men like him because he's a bit like, you know, those football managers like kind of Bill Shankly or Alex Ferguson or some of those guys.
Yeah, he appeals to both men and women. I mean, I was reading, obviously, many articles in preparation for this interview, and you've become a veritable sex symbol as Ted Hastings.
Apparently, yeah. I mean, it really is news to me, that one. And and the subject of some amusement, it has to be said. But, yeah, well, that's one of the things about being on telly, isn't it, Miriam? You know, you just become an object of people's interest. So you have to kind of run with that in particular, I think.
When you first got the script, Adrian, did you think it would become as big as it has become? I mean, that episode last Sunday is the biggest rating programme on British television this year.
Yeah, no, I mean, when we first got on the first series, you know, we weren't in possession of all the facts in the first series, really. We didn't know whether it was going to go to a second series. In fact, most of us thought if it did go to a second series, it would probably be a second series starring Lenny James, who was the lead in that particular series. But we didn't realise at that moment that Jed was inventing a format whereby a lead would come in and take over the show, not just be a guest lead with other characters, but actually it would be about them. And after the first series, there was a bit of a hiatus before the, you know, we got the nod to say, yes, you can do series two. So then Jed wrote series two, and it was only sort of towards the end of the second episode. We didn't do good numbers the first episode of series two, but towards the end of the second episode, things started to kick off and the real interest in the show started. And I think it's because it's got a very interesting format. It's genuinely procedural in many ways. You know, incrementally, people are trawling through photographs. It shows you how a lot of real police work is done. Yeah, it's just really caught people's imagination in that way, because it's also complicated. There's lots of payoffs the more you stick with it, you know, because Jed has orchestrated a very interesting arc through all the series whereby, you know, you get payoffs with characters returning and, you know, different bits of information showing up again. And so it's led to this real kind of detailed forensic type interest from the public, who are desperate to watch it in real time, which is why we get the big numbers, because nobody wants to kind of know beforehand and nobody wants to be the person at work the next day who doesn't know what's happened. And the public are great. Journalists have been good with us as well, not giving anything away. And then the public, basically, when they meet you, they will say, look, we love the show, please don't tell us what's happening. You know, they genuinely say that. So it's had that, what they call the water cooler stuff, where people like to meet on a Monday morning at work and talk about it.
And, of course, there's your Northern Irish-isms, which have become quite big, Adrian. I believe it's like a bingo game or a drinking game about things Ted might say, like, now we're sucking diesel, for instance.
Yeah, apparently that's right. If, you know, if certain things are said, you have to kind of have it. So, now we're sucking diesel, you might have to knock back a shot of tequila or something. Then, every time I say fella, I think that's, you know, it's a half pint of beer. I mean, you know, you could end up getting completely wasted listening to Ted on that Sunday night, to tell you the truth.
And what about I didn't come up the lagging in a bubble? Did anybody get that?
In a bubble. Yeah, that's a really good Belfast one. I'm drumming up a few more for the next series. You know, but that one came out of a Q&A session we had in Belfast where we asked people to write down a few Belfast phrases so that we could maybe include them. But the rest of them just come out, or, you know, Jed hears about them and he drops them in. I kind of have to rein him back now and again because he can go too far with it.
Of course, it's set in an unnamed British city but filmed in Northern Ireland. As a good Fermanagh boy, was it very nice to be able to film at home?
Oh, yeah, no, it's great. It's great. Belfast is a great city. You know, it's very easy to rattle around, and I've lots of friends there over the years. You know, I did a lot of work at the Lyric Theatre there, and, you know, we're still very committed to the city and, you know, and doing things there. So yeah, it's great. It's great to be in Belfast, and still very handy, you know, to get back into London, nipping across if we're a few days off here and there. And also I can get down to Enniskillen, where I'm from, and, you know, I have a house down in North County Leitrim, that part of the world, so I like getting down there as well.
And tell me a little bit about your background. Are you the eldest of seven, Adrian? And one thing I was reading, did you end up moving to Portadown and almost living on the Garvaghy Road for a while?
Yes, at the end of the 60s, when we were living in Enniskillen, we decided, my father was from Portadown, so we moved to Portadown, and we moved to an estate called Churchill Park, very ironically, which is on the Garvaghy Road. And so we saw through about 5 or 6 years of the early 1970s living there, which wasn't a nice place to be at all. There's a kind of very small nationalist community that lives in the kind of northwest corner of the town, so where Drumcree is and all that. So that was kind of an eye-opener, because I wasn't kind of quite aware of the kind of sectarian nature of life in Northern Ireland, having been brought up in Enniskillen, which is a very much more liberal place to grow up than somewhere like Portadown. So, but we returned to Enniskillen then, which was great, and to get back to the Fermanagh and the lakes and people I've grown up with. So it was a very tough place to live at that point. But yes, I am the oldest of seven. My dad died when I was, you know, in my early 20s, and at drama school. And then, you know, my mother, bless her, she's still alive and in Enniskillen, and my sisters and brothers are there. So I have a sister in Ratoath and a sister in Bundoran, and then two sisters in Enniskillen and my two brothers. So we're still very much around the town, you know.
It's great, and it's great your mom is still around. And I read also you had a tricky, like many people have, relationship with your dad, didn't you? And almost he died before many people have time to resolve those issues.
Yeah, that's right. I think most people are the same thing. You know, I mean, I was the oldest. You know, he was a carpenter. He had, you know, seven kids. I mean, he didn't have much time to really devote to any of us. He was working all the time, you know. So in a way, I suppose, you know, I just, you know, had he lived, I mean, you know, he was 50. Had he lived a little bit longer, we may have been able to establish a relationship. But, you know, it wasn't through any fault of either of us. I just think we were both heading off in different directions. I just wish he'd lived a bit longer so he could have seen some of the stuff that I did. I know there's a lot of people out there who would have the same thoughts.
Lots of people I interview, actually, Adrian, say that. And also they often say they look back now on the lives of maybe their father or their mother, but often their father, and think, you know, they were just working hard to try to provide food for their children.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. He, you know, he worked really hard. He didn't drink. You know, he ran his car and he had a cigarette now and again. And that was, you know, that was it. The rest of his life was about working for his family. And, you know, it's only in retrospect, as you said, that you start to see your parents in that light and the sacrifices that they made.
So where did the performing trait come from? I gather your mum liked performing, did she?
Yes, my mother was a really good singer. And, I mean, you know, she actually sang on the radio, sang on RTE way, way back in the days, and the you know, and so she sung in the choir and in the Enniskillen since she was about seven, and she's 86 now, and so not that she gets to the choir anymore, but because her voice is gone, also her memory is going, and so, but she instilled in that kind of idea of you know, performance and being on the stage, and you know, so I got a taste of that when I was young, and she always had a piano, and we always did stuff at Christmas for carols and things like that. So there was always music about the house. My father also, he loves tenors. He loves, you know, I did a film about Joseph Locke called Hear My Song, and my father's a big Joe Locke fan. He was also a fan of Mario Lanza and Geely and Kenneth McKellar. Tenors, he loved tenors, and Irish tenors in particular, and so that kind of, you know, there was a background of that. So I thought I'd probably end up, you know, doing something with music. I didn't necessarily think I was going to be an actor. But then I did some work locally for the amateur work. And, you know, it's very big and very strong, the amateur tradition in Ireland and in the stage. And long may it be so. And so that's where I started. And then I got an audition for the drama school in London, because I did a play, very famous Dublin play by a guy called Heno McGee, called The Scatterin', which is a really excellent play. And we did a version of that. And I basically got into drama school on the back of an audition speech from that play. So I've always been grateful to that. And then I did sort of 3 years in London, and then beyond that, just started working, you know.
And you've been in a lot of great films, but almost, do you think Ted Hastings is almost your biggest and most successful role so far? What do you think about that?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, definitely it is. And, you know, but, I mean, this does happen, Miriam. I mean, you know, it happens to a lot of actors, you know. They and there's a lot of actors out there who I know are wonderful actors. And now and again, one of us gets a part, like Ted Hastings, that we can throw all our stuff at. And, you know, whilst our contemporaries are sitting around going, well, you know, I knew Eddie could do that stuff, it's only when I get the part, you know, like Ted, that I can kind of do it all, if you like, and get the chance to do it all. So, you know, it's a real gift at this stage, you know, of my career, having been doing the whole thing for 40 years now, that a part like this has come along. I feel really, really lucky, to tell you the truth.
Well, they're lucky to have you do it because you play him so well.
Well, thank you for that.
Listen, you're also a director, and I remember, I think it was 2017, you directed Homer's Odyssey in a beach in Donegal, and I think you once said, Adrian, that Donegal was always an escape almost from the troubles. So was going back to a beach there part of your own odyssey, your own journey?
Yeah, well, you might say that, but it's a really wonderful experience, that. I mean, there's no doubt, there's any northern nationalist will tell you, you know, that bit where you cross the border back in the bad old days was such a relief. It was a difficult time that everybody lived through, and you know, we would hate to return to it. And of course, there's a lot of casualties in the north since then. You know, those people are still there. There's still towns like Inniskillen and Omagh and cities like Belfast and Derry where there are still people in those. You know, you could be at a party on a Saturday night and someone might break down because, you know, they suddenly saw someone and they remember the last time that they saw them, and it was a very difficult situation. You get things like that happening all the time. We tend to forget that the bang and the legacy of all that is still there. There's definitely that feeling. It was great to get away in the summer to go to a place that was experiencing peace. And we were very jealous of that, of course. Very jealous that, you know, our brothers and sisters in the South and the Republic were getting on with their lives. And, you know, and with what's happening at the moment, you know, we don't really want to go back to all that stuff. We'd really like to see it, you know, see that resolved so that maybe we can get on with our lives as well.
So you were probably very moved the way everybody on this island was by the words of the priest, Father McGill, at Lyra McKee's funeral. Were you, Adrian?
Well, yes, I think we all were. That's a real retrograde step, the death of that young girl. I mean, you know, I think we all felt that. It was very, very disappointing that suddenly we found ourselves there again. But, you know, the whole thing started because there was a political vacuum in the first place. And, you know, and into that vacuum steps someone or something. So we have to be aware of that. You know, there's a lot of young people growing up who may not remember what it was like. And, you know, that's why the legacy issues, that's why we have to work through the Good Friday Agreement. The Good Friday Agreement is there so we can work through these things and remind one another just how bad it was so that we will not make the mistakes again. It's surprising how quickly some people can forget.
So true. And you keep very connected, as you said, with Belfast Theatre. And I know you love Van the Man.
I do, yeah. He's something else and he just keeps going. You know, the interesting thing about Van is that, you know, he really hasn't changed since he was 17. Not many people know how they're going to sing, what they're going to do from that young age. You know, most musicians and entertainers have spent a long time finding their voice. But he seems to have known who he was right from the get-go, and I think that's extraordinary. And Van's still on the road. He's been on the road all his life, and I know he's getting tired of it. But as I said to him the other day, you'll just have to stop being good.
Is it possible, if we wanted to play one of Van's great pieces, do you have a favourite song, or is that, I know you're a close friend of his, is there a particular piece we could go out on today that you like of Van's?
Well, there's one song that doesn't get played a lot that I really like. It's called Tupelo Honey. It's a very sweet song.
Finally, when do you start filming the next series of Line of Duty, Adrian?
Well, we only have one writer, Jed Mercurio, so we have to wait on Jed. And I suspect it'll be sometime next year, maybe at the start of next year.
Well, look, thanks so much, Adrian. Congrats on all your success, and especially for that wonderful role, Ted Hastings. And continued with all your success, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Not at all, Marion. Thank you.
The tea in China, put it in a big brown bag for me. Sail right around the seven oceans, drop it straight into the deep blue sea.
And the winner of our competition today is Patrick Crabb, Cabra West, Dublin 7. You're going to see Mariah Carey. Thanks so much. Loads of reaction here, especially to Lelia Doolan. People loved her. Thanks so much for listening. We're here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, slán.
She is sweet. It's Tupelo, honey.